Let's talk about Mark. Actually, we're talking about the Gospel of Mark, but I knew that I could make him read for a minute there. we're going to hop right in because later we'll get to some other elements that are going to be kind of fun. But we're going to be spending some time in the glorious and mysterious book of Mark over the next few weeks. Mark is really interesting because it's at least argued. Your wife is cracking up, man. That's a terrible thing to do, Melissa. Listen, Mark is interesting. Melissa's like, poof, you don't know him well enough. Wow. Ouch. Guys, you guys need a quiet afternoon together after this morning. It's going to need to practice some reconciliation. All right. So, Melissa, you're not allowed to laugh that loud anymore if you want me to try to stay focused here. Okay. All right, every time I mention Mark, you can't lose it. Okay, so the Gospel of Mark is unique because it is the only gospel that's not attributed to a direct disciple of Jesus at the time. Most historians, theologians think that Mark was written by this guy called John Mark, who makes his entrance in the book of Acts as a companion of Paul and Barnabas on their missionary journeys, okay? So Paul and Barnabas are on this missionary journey. They bring this guy named John Mark along, and something happens along the journey. We're not going to get into this too much, but I want to give some background. So something happens, and Mark leaves, okay? He deserts. Maybe there's a conflict. Maybe he has some issue, you know? Maybe he's got a weak stomach, and he keeps getting sick, and so he goes home because he can't stand the travel. We don't know what happened. But anyways, the next time that Paul gets ready to go on a missionary journey in Acts 15, in the second half of the book of Acts, Barnabas says, great, we're getting the team back together. Let's get Mark. And Paul says, no, I don't want to bring him. And it leads to kind of a bit of a rift. And so Barnabas says, well, I'm going to take Mark with me, and we'll go in a different direction. We don't know how bitter kind of this went down. We hope it was done in a Christ-like, loving way. It might have just been our personalities don't match well to, you know, be sleeping beside each other on the road every night for a couple months here. But Paul grabs Silas and takes him for his own missionary journey in a slightly different direction. I say that because Mark gives a perspective on the gospel that is one that's rather full of pain, rather kind of full of forlornment. Is that a word? It is now. Mark's the way each gospel writer presents their story is fascinating. They each have different reasons for telling the Jesus story, and so they have different emphases that they use in the midst of these. And so one of Mark's emphases is that the disciples kind of are tragic characters most of the time. They experience a lot of pain. They don't get it. Most of their time in the first half of the gospel of Mark, most of the time they talk with Jesus is to tell him he's wrong about something. Like, Jesus, no, that's not a good idea. You shouldn't be doing that. And so we get all of these things. But because of that, they have trouble figuring out what's going on. Hallmark of the Gospel of Mark. This is why I love the Gospel of Mark. Most people think because it's the shortest, it's the simplest in many ways in terms of its writing, that it's kind of like the boring one. And so we like to hang out in Matthew or Luke or John because John's like super mystical. Matthew, Jesus is this brilliant teacher. Luke, Jesus is really, his focus on the poor and justice is elevated. And Mark is just kind of like source material for the others. And so a lot of the gospel writers drew from Mark's first. Mark is brilliant. And here's why. Core to the Gospel of Mark is an understanding of having to work a little bit and dig a little bit under the surface in order to get it. Mark never comes out explicitly even and says who Jesus is. It's crazy. In the first chapter, he heals this guy that has demon possession, and he says, shh, don't tell anybody what I've done. It's really, really, really interesting. Throughout, he says in Mark 4, he says to the disciples, you've been given the secret of the kingdom, but others haven't because they don't yet have eyes to see and ears to hear. So Jesus kind of presents this idea of the kingdom that's coming into the world, God's kingdom, and he says, a lot of people will see it or hear about it, but they won't grasp what it really is. That takes a little bit of digging. under the surface. It's like a secret. And so the whole Gospel of Mark is this journey of discovering what the secret is. And the secret is about who Jesus is, and the secret is about the nature of the kingdom. And it's a good secret. You know the difference between a good secret and a bad secret, right? A bad secret fills you with shame or fills others with shame, and you don't want it to be found out. But a good secret, totally different, right? A good secret, what makes a good secret good?
Exciting.
It's exciting because one day, the right person's going to find out, and it's going to be awesome. That's what makes a secret a good secret. A good secret is that ring burning a hole in my pocket, right? A good secret is that surprise party that I'm bringing my friend to who doesn't know about it yet, unless they're not into surprise parties. And then if you marry somebody that's not into surprise parties, don't throw surprise parties for them. For a friend, I'm telling you that. So good surprises, good secrets, they're meant to be revealed at the right time, and it brings this amazing joy when it does. A good secret is that plus sign that we're just waiting to tell others about, right? There are secrets that are beautiful and wonderful, and the kingdom of God in the book of Mark is presented as this beautiful secret that people have to work a little bit to figure out, but when they do, it's amazingly good news, okay? So that's why we want to have some fun with this. Mark, like I said, Mark doesn't explicitly state too many things about the nature of who Jesus is on purpose. But he implicitly says a whole lot. And so this is the fun part that we get to do. So we get to nerd out just a little bit when we get into the Gospel of Mark, because we get to see what he means when he says this, but we're supposed to be thinking about this. And oh my gosh, it starts blowing our minds. At least I think that that's what's going to happen. So hopefully the same thing will happen to you as it does to me as I get into this stuff. All right, so, We are going to look under the surface by telling five interesting and compelling stories from the book of Mark over the next 5 weeks, okay? And these are stories that you might know fairly well, you may have heard them before, but they're stories that have great meaning on the surface, and then they have even better meaning as you dig down a little bit, okay? So that's kind of the goal of what we're going to do, and the idea of where we're going is we're kind of couching this whole series of conversations in terms of the question that Jesus asks Peter in Mark 8. And Jesus asks Peter the question, after all these experiences have happened, so who do you say that I am? And that is really Mark's journey, is he wants to tell the story of Jesus in order to help people answer that question. And so that's what we're going to be uncovering and revealing and seeing what the implications are like. This should be fun. Ready? Okay. You hear that, right? I've been out in some pretty intense situations. In 2002, I spent 9 days on a canoe with my dad and my uncle and his son. They had a second canoe. In the Minnesota-Canada canoe area Boundary Waters Wilderness. Largest stretch of wilderness in North America. Ironically, I thought it'd be up in the Yukon, but apparently, or at least in the settled, civilized region. Over 1 million square acres of pristine, untouched by roads and motors and most people beauty. It's amazing. The only way you can travel is by canoe and these little footpaths between one lake and another. You portage between them. And so I fabulously found a couple of the pictures from this trip that we took, how many years ago? 15 years ago now. And so this was preparing to go. That's how you would travel. We had, those are backpacks. That's my dad on the right. Those are 75-pound backpacks on the front and on the back. So you could just feel it crushing in on you. But that's because we had it professionally outfitted, and the food that they gave us was fabulous. We were like grilling steaks at night and all kinds of great stuff. And so the purpose was a wilderness experience. The purpose was adventure. The purpose was to do a lot of fishing. This is some of the greatest fishing areas. And so we went to fish, and it was a lot of fun for the most part, but sometimes you caught fish that were the same size as your lure, and there was a little bit frustrating. So that is me in a different time and a different place. Holy cow. But we were, you know, we did catch some northern pike. I don't know how many people are fishers here. I don't fish much anymore, but I sure did love it when I was younger. And we would catch, you know, 25, 28-inch northern pike and some really exciting things. So one day, sorry, that was a diversion. So one day we were at We would stay at a campsite for 2 or 3 days at a time, and then we would take day trips in the canoe with lighter gear to go fishing and exploring and cliff jumping and stuff like that. And so one day, we were about 3 lakes over from our campsite. We weren't traveling from campsite to campsite at that point. We were just going out for a day trip. And we're kind of on other opposite sides of the lake, and it's maybe 3:30 in the afternoon. And we hear a call from my uncle and his son. It was actually his graduation gift, and they invited us to join them for it. So it was kind of a fun adventure with two fathers and sons. And we hear them calling out across the lake, and we turned around, and they're waving and pointing to the far horizon. And on the far horizon, there's this kind of little black dot. I'm like, what is that? And we just kind of stare at it, and it only takes about a minute of trying to figure out what it is before it gets bigger, and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And we're like, oh, that's a black cloud. And that thing is moving really, really quickly. I'm not sure if any of you have ever spent time in the Minnesota kind of region. What's that called? Cold. What was it? The Great Lakes region, I guess? Okay. So in that region of the country, but the storms there are bonkers. And so all of a sudden, we see that there is a significant storm bearing down on us. And we realize that we are really far away from our campsite. So it's time to turn back. So we start turning back, and this storm is on us within probably 20 minutes. And you can see for miles. So it's not long before we are in torrential downpours. But we're going across, and we get across like 2 lakes. And by this time, it's about 5:45. It's almost dark. And we are portaging to our final lake, where our campsite is on the other side. But here's the thing. We know where our campsite is, because you have to kind of go by the little coves, and we could see our tent when you get near it. But it was already, the sun was going down early, or was covered up early because of this. And so we realized if we didn't get on it really, really quickly, we weren't going to be able to get across the lake in time. The problem is that the lightning had just come, and the lightning and thunderstorm had really, really hit hard. So we're sitting here, my dad and I, and we're looking across the lake having no idea where our campsite is. And we're faced with the reality of, if we don't go across in the middle of this storm, which sounds stupid, it just sounds absolutely stupid to canoe across a lake in the middle of a storm, a lightning storm, then we wouldn't really have any way of ever finding our campsite tonight. And we'd be stuck on the far side with no food, with no shelter. Not that a tent was like enormous shelter, but it was going to be rough. And so we talked about it, and we decided that we were going to go out on this lake. And so we did. And I remember the experience of being about a third of the way with lightning striking around us. It was a Kevlar canoe, so we're like, does this help? If it was aluminum, I'd think we might be goners. But like, how far? We're actually having conversations. How far away can lightning strike before you get electrocuted? Do you know, Dad? Like, you're supposed to know this stuff. Please, tell me. Tell me at some point that you looked this up. And so we don't have any idea, but I remember thinking, so this is how it's going to go down. It's going to be on a lake in the middle of Minnesota. This is how it's all going to end. This is ridiculous. Getting caught in a storm is no joke. We become kind of inoculated to it when we get used to the fact that we have these wonderful shelters around us. But getting caught in a storm is a terrifying experience. We're looking at the time this morning that Jesus got caught in a storm, if we can even use that kind of phrase with it. But we're looking at a story in Mark 4, 35 to 41. And the story is dripping with meaning all throughout it beyond what we might see. And so we're going to start, and we're just going to kind of work through it a little bit, bit by bit, and we're going to have some fun with it. And so Mark 4 says this. You know what? I'm going to read the whole story to you. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let's go," this is Jesus, "let's go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. Probably want to make note of that for later. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." Fascinating, fascinating story. Let's start from the beginning. That day, we should know, any time that you get something like that, we should ask, what day? If it's that day, then why is he saying that day? So that day is the day that Jesus had been teaching all day long about the parables of the kingdom, about how the kingdom of God was this unstoppable force. The last story he told was about a mustard seed. He's been on a boat, by the way, this entire time. So in the morning, they're near the Sea of Galilee, just a big lake, and they're near there. The crowd's pressing him down. He knows that natural amphitheater experience can happen if someone's out on the water because of the way your voice echoes. So he goes out, they anchor a little bit offshore, and he starts to teach, and he teaches all day long. But he's teaching these stories, these mysterious hidden stories. He only uses parables. He doesn't say anything explicit, and he teaches about the kingdom of God and how nothing can stop it. It's like a mustard seed that takes over hillsides before you know it. And you try to uproot it, but it's already spread seed, and the next plants are coming up, and it's just unstoppable. Okay? So it's that day. So that day, when evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, let's go over to the other side. Interestingly, the other side was the Decapolis, the kind of the center of the Roman rule. In many ways, in terms of the military and the opposition. And so he's kind of saying, let's head over into enemy territory and let's continue this mission ministry thing. So that's just a little side note. We're not going to talk about that, but there might have been some anxiety in the disciples about this. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was. Just as he was means that we're probably talking about Jesus was in the boat the whole time, finished teaching, and he's sitting there. He said, let's just go to the other side of the boat. So there was not a lot of time for preparation, yeah? So there's no like big preparation, getting all the right gear together or all the right food into all that kind of stuff. So this is what happens. And he leaves the crowd behind, and they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. Okay. A furious squall came up. Literally a great storm came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. The Sea of Galilee was 600 feet below sea level. Okay, so we are talking about a very, very low hanging sea. So the hot air would rise and it would hit the colder streams of air that were going above it. And it would create this momentary turbulence that would turn a calm day into a massively stormy day. So anybody who knows the region looks at this, and that's not a shocker that a storm came up on the Sea of Galilee because of the nature of this. This would happen constantly. And you couldn't really see it coming frequently like I could see in Minnesota as it rolled over the hills and the woodlands. So the storm goes really quick, and we've got fishermen who are not used to being this far off of shore. I think it's the Phoenicians that lived a bit more north. They were the seafaring people. The Galileans were not seafaring people whatsoever. We talk a lot about the fishermen, but in reality, they stayed really close to shore. You know the Moana, the movie? You know how, like, her people, they stay inside the reef, right? So that's like the Galileans. They fished inside the reef, but they never went out into the deep water. You know, that they let other people do that. They were not a seafaring people. So these Galileans, not used to this sort of thing being out in the deep water, they would stay closer to the shore when they were fishing. So they are in over their heads, literally and figuratively. And the boat is nearly swamped. And then Jesus comes into the story, and what is Jesus doing? Jesus is sleeping in the stern of the boat. So the boat would have kind of this little leather cap with a bit of an overdwelling shield that someone could sit in to take shelter or to rest. And so Jesus is up in that spot, and he is resting after a hard, long day of work, of teaching the crowds. Now, sleep in the scriptures is often referred to in one of two ways. Number one, sleep can be a sign of amazing peace, right? In Psalm 4, we see, in peace I will lie down and sleep, for you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. Okay, so there's this idea of sleeping during something that might be intense, and it shows peace with God. There's also another understanding of sleeping in moments like this, right? And it's lazy, or it's irresponsible, or something like that. And so the disciples look at Jesus, and they say, this was definitely the latter. They wake him up, and they say, teacher, don't you care if we drown? The disciples are freaking out, and it makes zero sense that Jesus is sleeping at the moment. Yeah? This is completely inappropriate behavior, Jesus. Don't you care about us? What a fascinating question. So, I want you to think about something. I want you to think, what did the disciples want Jesus to do? What do you think they wanted him to do? Do you think they wanted him to stop the storm? Because they're shocked when he does. So we kind of naturally think, well, that's what they were. They were waking him up and saying, Jesus, do this, stop the storm. And so when Jesus would do it, they would have been like, thank you, Jesus. That's not what happens, is it? They are absolutely terrified. They're not expecting Jesus to do this. Why not? What are they expecting Jesus to do? Here's where we get to dig. Okay, now it's time to dive deeper. Remember that Mark intends that we read meaning under the surface to discover who Jesus really was and what the kingdom was about. So he often used stories that people would have understood with various levels of meaning. So here's your deal. He almost never quotes the Old Testament, Mark himself, as the author of the gospel. He has characters that quote the Old Testament from time to time. But the Old Testament meaning is dripping in this story. So tell me, those of you who may be familiar with the Old Testament, tell me a story about experienced sailors facing a storm at sea, and when they are threatened, there is some serious crying out to God, and somebody is asleep. Go. Jonah, right? The story of Jonah. Lord sent a great wind on the sea. Jonah's trying to run from God's calling to speak a message of conversion to the Ninevites. He tries to flee to this place called Tarshish, and when he's going, he gets on a boat, and bad things happen because he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, and the sailors, all of a sudden, they're freaking out. They all start praying to their gods, and they see Jonah's asleep, and they say, what are you doing? And they have a similar kind of experience that the disciples do when they find him asleep. They wake him up. Mark intends for us to look at this story and see Jonah unfolding. So what did the disciples wake Jesus up for? What do the sailors wake Jonah up to do? What do they want? The disciples wake Jesus up and say, Jesus, don't you care if we drown? Bail some water. Jesus, give us last rites. We're going down. Jesus, you know, lend a hand. What do the disciples want to do? We are supposed to be good Jewish readers if we're reading this story of Mark, and we're supposed to know exactly what's coming. What do they want him to do? Call upon his God. Yes, they want him to pray. They say, Jesus, don't you care if we drown? And we have this parallel story where we are supposed to see the story of Jonah. And what they wake Jesus up to do is to pray to his God to save them. And what does Jesus do? He says, you just did. And he looks, and literally he shushes the storm. Hush. Be quiet. The word is a similar phrase that you might use to chide a child. Shh, be quiet. He almost minimizes this storm. Fascinating moment. And the disciples are terrified because they asked him to call, or they were intending, at least the way Mark presents the story, Mark wants us to see that they were intending to say, Jesus, call on your God. And Jesus just says, hold up, I'll take care of it. And this is terrifying. This is absolutely terrifying to them. Why is it so terrifying? They've seen Jesus heal demon possession, lepers. Why is it so terrifying? Maybe it's because they were familiar with the Psalms. Psalm 65. You answer us with awesome and righteous deeds, God, the hope of all the ends of the earth and the far of the seas, who formed the mountains by your power, having armed yourself with strength, who stilled the roaring of the seas, the roaring of their waves, and the turmoil of the nations. Jesus steps in, and he does the thing that only God can do. And the disciples are thinking, this guy is powerful, but they aren't thinking this guy is God. And that shift is something Mark deeply desires for us to catch, because it changes things. So Jesus turns and he hushes the storm. He says, quiet, be still. Now, can you imagine? I mean, we've heard maybe the story some. Can you imagine actually sitting there? Can you just imagine that for a moment? Imagine standing outside and someone beside you looks around and they go, "Hush, be still." And the rain just stops. Sometimes we just need to sit in these stories and be filled with wonder. It's kind of a different emotion for the disciples, however. So Jesus speaks calm to the storm. He says, literally it's be muzzled, like you'd say to a dog. Be muzzled. Shut your mouth. Oh, it's the same, interesting, same word he says in chapter 1 to the demon when he exorcises the man. Be muzzled. But he only does that for a moment, and then he turns, because he calms the storm almost in a minimal way, and then he has to turn, and then he has to calm the disciples. And so in light of all that, when he moves to calm the disciples, he looks at them, and what we get is this awesome thing. Where's the storm? Let's see. Do I have it here? Yes. Okay. So we said it was a great storm before. Oh, wrong one. There we go. We said it was a great storm. So the original Greek says that he got up, he rebuked the wind, he said the waves quiet, and the wind died down, and it was completely calm. That phrase is the same great. They use the same word. So there was a great storm that came up and a great calm that came over the place, okay? And so in the midst of this great calm, Jesus looks over and he says to the disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" Well, let's just take a step back here. This is a legit life-threatening situation, yeah? Legitimate. Why are you afraid? And the disciples, well, duh. Jesus says, no, duh. Uh-uh. Why are you afraid? Interestingly, he says that in a complete present tense. Both of those things. So literally, he says, what's frightening you now? How is it that you still have no trust? Remember, faith and trust are the exact same words. Exact same word. I wish they were interchanged more in the scriptures. Every time you hear faith, the word pistuo, it means trust and faith. Same word, interchangeably. Every time you read trust, it's the same word as well. Why do you not trust? Why are you still not trusting? So the fact that this is present tense says to me three things. Okay? Let's see. Where are we? Okay, here we go. I think three things happen when we experience this reality that Mark is setting up about fear versus faith. And this is where we get to the meat of what really matters here this morning. There's three possibilities of what Jesus might have been saying to his disciples. One is, after all that you've seen me do, why do you respond with fear when situations like this arrive? After what you've witnessed, Why is this the response that's still coming out of you? The second thing that might be being pointed at by kind of this present tense idea is, in light of everything that you've heard me teach all day, this ongoing message about the kingdom of God being powerful and beautiful and strong and unstoppable, do you really think a storm's going to bring it down? Do you really think that somehow this is going to get in the way? The magnitude of what I've been speaking about, the goodness that is creeping into the world through my spirit. And the third option, I think, is really, really interesting, and that is, why are you still panicking now? It's a very possible reading of this because of the use of his tense. Why? There's calm all around you. Why are you still panicking now? Where is your fear coming from? And I think in our world, we need to take this story very seriously. There is such a world of fear surrounding us all the time. And as much as we want to fight against it, it works its way into us, it works its way into the church, it works its way into our relationships. And I think sometimes it's because of these three scenarios that may happen that we end up letting fear overcome our faith. After all you've seen me do, why do you respond with fear when situations arise? For me, I think this is about memory. Let's see if I can get this here. I think often what happens is, in the midst of insane situations or overwhelming emotional moments, we forget the stories that have already shaped us. We forget where we've seen Jesus at work in our lives. And it's in that instantaneous circumstance where we just totally are so fixated on what's happening around us that we lose sight of the faithfulness of God that we've seen through the ages. And maybe you haven't seen that yet. Maybe you haven't, maybe you haven't. But this is why the importance of telling stories matters so much. Psalms say, one generation is going to praise your works to another. We're going to tell the stories of what you've done, God, over and over and over. And we need to learn, when we have short-term memories about God's faithfulness, we need to learn how to tell the stories, and we need to tell the stories to others who maybe are like, I don't know how to trust God. You got to be able to say, let me tell you my story. Let me tell you what I've seen. We have to tell our stories. It's how the church maintains the strength of its foundation. We remind each other of God's goodness and faithfulness. The second thing, after the problem of memory, the second thing of, in light of everything you know about the kingdom, how can you think this storm would stop it? See, this is an issue of a problem of faith. So the first one is a problem of memory, of forgetting. The second one is a problem of faith because we don't continue to speak the truth of the kingdom in moments where it's really hard to see the kingdom. So it's just a slight difference than telling our stories. We remind each other of the nature of God's kingdom. We remind each other that, hey, God's kingdom, it grows like a mustard seed. What that means is that sometimes the plant is growing and it's really hard to see it, but it's powerful and it's strong and it's not going to stop because God is doing something. So the way that we do this is we speak truth to one another. We speak what's true and real when we are overwhelmed by violence and we are overwhelmed by hurt and we are overwhelmed by destruction all around us and hopelessness and despair. When something happens in our lives and we just want to give up on the need for real relationships with other people, give up on the need to continue working for good and healing and peace in the world. We have to remind ourselves the nature of God's kingdom. We have to speak what's true to one another. And then the final thing, why are you still panicking? This great storm has given way to great calm. This is a big one. I think this speaks to the paralysis that we often experience. Because here's the crazy thing. Some of you have grown up hearing the story of God's goodness, and you've actually experienced it, and it doesn't change the way that you feel almost every day. You're still overcome with fear. We live in a culture of fear where the world around us uses fear to control emotions and uses fear to motivate. And fear is a heck of a motivator because it captures some of our deepest, deepest experiences. It captures some of our deepest insecurities. We can know something and still be paralyzed to be able to live any differently. And there is only one way to get past paralysis. And that is that we have to sit with Jesus in the storm. What do you think Jesus wanted the disciples to do? This is rhetorical. I'm not going to answer it. I have no idea. I've tried. Do you think he wanted them to, that's a hard bill, to just rest with him? Whew! To wake him up and say, Jesus, I'm going to sit with you here. Maybe you asleep is a little bit terrifying for me, but can I sit with you? I have no idea. That sounds way too high and holy for me. Goodness gracious, I don't have that kind of faith most days. But I want us to think about that. Why are you still panicking? We are a people captivated by fear, and Jesus calls us to be captivated by the kingdom, to be captivated by his love. Jesus invites us to have our attention fixed on him in such a way that we can say, oh my gosh, the storm is crazy, but I'm sitting with the creator of the world in the boat. Jesus says, don't you get it? What's the worst that can happen, guys? What is the worst that can happen? Paul says height or depth and there's anything in all creation can separate us from God's love. Nothing. What's the worst that can happen? That you die with the creator of the world alongside you? If the boat goes down, I'm going down with it. Don't worry. I am with you. I am with you. I am with you. There is presence that is spoken over and over here, and that changes how we live in every single way. Paul knew that in Philippians 2. He speaks about it frequently. See if I've got it here. Maybe I didn't pull it up. I might not have put it up here. I don't think I did. Paul says, listen, when you're experiencing moments of terror and stress and heartache and anxiety, bring your prayers and petitions to God. And God's peace, which is beyond what makes sense, will guard your hearts and minds. And so Paul understood that there was this peace that Jesus can speak beyond the situation. Jesus speaks peace to the situation, but then he shifts his real focus to speak peace to the disciples. We have to grasp this more. I think sometimes when we struggle with knowing how or where we see God or feel God or say, well, God's not always exactly showing up in the ways that I want or in the way that I feel, and there's mystery there, which is absolutely true, we throw all of this out about what God can do in the midst of our storms and what the supernatural moments can actually be, and we need to reclaim that. We need to not be afraid of that. This experience of trust that Jesus calls us to, it's not like about Zen. It doesn't mean that we remain unaffected by the world, okay? This is really important. It is internal in many ways, but it doesn't mean that we walk through life unaffected by its realities. What it means is not a removal of circumstance. It doesn't mean that we don't mourn, but we don't mourn as people that have no hope. It doesn't mean that we don't suffer, but we don't suffer as people that have no hope. It doesn't mean that we don't feel brokenness, but we don't feel brokenness as people that are hopeless. We still experience these realities of life, the struggle, the hurt, even the fear, but we do not fear as people who have no hope. We fear knowing that there is something that can overcome it, and we can't live in this fear all the time. We do it so much. So much of our lives is controlled by fear. So it doesn't mean we're unaffected, but it also doesn't mean that it's just internal. If we actually come to a point where we are sitting in that boat with Jesus and we are looking around and we are saying, you know what? The circumstances are really overwhelming. I am terrified. I am overwhelmed. I am struggling. But you know what? Jesus is in the boat here. And if we can walk with that true conviction, it will change the way that we are free to live the rest of our lives. So it's not just this internal happy world for me. It's me being able to look around and say, I can love with greater capacity. I can give of my time and my energy with greater integrity because I know that I am going to be okay because nothing can separate us from God. Because Jesus is right here saying, have a little faith, will you? Now, unfortunately, the end of the story is that the disciples are held with a great fear. You know, same word? Great storm comes, great calm overtakes it, great fear holds on to the disciples. Now, we can look at that and be like, oh, you guys are stupid. But like, if you're sitting in the boat and you start to realize that this might be God, you can be a little bit afraid, right? And Jesus actually he spends the rest of Mark trying to help them understand the nature of this God. It's not one to be terrified of. It's one to be embraced by. But anyways, the disciples still give us a little bit of encouragement when they are not fully able to grasp everything that happens even at the end of this story. But what they do say is, one more. Oh, I got Philippians 4 there. I just skipped right over it earlier. Sorry about that. What they say is, who is this? Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey. I realized over the last couple weeks, I do a whole lot of encouraging you to do things. You probably are aware of this if you've been around a lot. I tend to be high on the doing and a little bit low on the being. The Jesus life is an active life of love for God and neighbors in multiple ways. However, sometimes we just need to sit in the boat and let that be the first transforming power and let Jesus deal with our fear so that we can then go and do all the things. So I'm not going to tell you to do all the things this morning. I'm not going to tell you to go out now that you've sat with Jesus in the boat and do X, Y, and Z. I want you to keep sitting with Jesus in the boat if that's what you need to do. I want you to be inspired by the reality that the God of the universe actually chose to dwell with people in order to help them journey toward him and toward life in its absolute fullest. That's inspiring. We have So like I said, I'm not going to do the whole application thing. Sometimes I like to do that. Sometimes I like to let you do it. Speaking of letting you do it, how about it? Let's try this. Let's pray for just a moment, and then if you have any responses, we will take them. Father, Creator, powerful God, I am overwhelmed by your choice of using your power to lay down your life. I pray that whoever is currently in situations where there's a fear, there's an anxiety, there's a circumstance, there's a storm that just feels too much, Lord, will you bring freedom? Will you speak? Will you shush it? Will you muzzle it? Will you speak peace and presence to every one of us so that we might live lightly and freely, God? We need this. It's hard to live freely in our world right now. Speak peace, Lord.